There's an old saying in the world that two things you don't ever want to talk about are religion and politics. And this morning I've been given the great opportunity to speak to you concerning both of these. Within the next 30 days, two of the most powerful political parties within our country will be holding their conventions. And they will take 4 days to lay out before the American people what it is they feel would be the best way to govern our country and the ideology which they feel best suit you and I. Although that's the way we conducted here in the United States in the year 2000, man has been governing himself in some way or another for thousands and thousands of years. And man, whether he likes it or not, is part of a nation, is part of a government, is part of a state. It's not really something that you and I, as citizens of the United States, can just voluntarily opt out of. But I'm not necessarily sure that it's something that you and I would necessarily want to opt out of. Because as citizens of this country, there are many benefits that we receive that we could not receive as mere individuals. Plato, thousands of years ago, said that the purpose of the state was so that man could find justice and safety. And it was in this time period that men understood that if they herded themselves together behind a wall, they could seek protection, and there was indeed strength in numbers that a man could not find by himself out in the wilderness. It was with this state that they found themselves protected from savage beasts and from other men. This concept of the state is one that still exists today. It's this idea that men have this covenant with which they maintain relationships through the observance of the given laws and ordinances of the country and land. Government is, in fact, one of the three institutions that we find God providing for us within the Bible. In the book of Genesis, we find that of the family and that of the government, two institutions that God found and deemed important from the very beginning. It's not until Acts, the second chapter, that we find the third institute with which God provided for us, and that is that of the church. One thing we must understand, though, is that the government only has authority within the civil realm, and it does not go beyond that in any way, shape, or form. You and I, as Christians and as believers, have a responsibility to say yes and to follow our government so long it does not contradict or conflict with those teachings which God would have us follow within the Bible. These three institutions clearly help us to maintain our relationships. And these three institutions help us to maintain our relationships in different ways. The idea of the family, we maintain our relationships with the parents and with the children. And the parents are the governing authority in that family institution because they govern and rule over the children. Likewise, within the church, we have elected officials or overseers who help to govern and to rule over the members of the church. And our government also has elected and ruling authorities which govern and dictate the citizens of this country. One time I took a political science class in which my professor defined politics as conflict. And after hearing that, I wasn't really sure that I was getting my money's worth. But after I thought about it, this idea of conflict is, in fact, what politics really is. It's this conflict, it's this struggle that man goes through in order to best see how he should govern himself and the land which he is a part of. Which brings me really to the thing I would like to talk to you about this morning. This idea of politics. Is this an arena that the Christian should be a part of? Is politics something that we should engage in? Should we try and have influence in the political realm? Or is it something that we should just have a hands-off attitude and not partake of in such an active way? Matthew, the 28th chapter, verses 19 to 20 read, "Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you." When I read this commission that Jesus gives to his apostles, I do not find anywhere within this commission a political agenda. I simply find a spiritual mandate, and that is all I find. I do not find a political agenda that he gives to his apostles there in that commission. Nowhere can I find with the early church making a concerted effort to try and change the Roman laws, which they were indeed subject to. I understand the appeal of involving yourself in politics, because it's this notion that through politics we can transform society. But I'd like for you to consider this morning that we need to have goals that are of an eternal nature, and not goals that are of such a temporal nature. Romans, the first chapter, the 16th verse reads, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who has faith." Merely reading that verse, why is it that we would want to preach anything else but the gospel? But people still want to seek moral reform through political action. But I find it difficult to read this command here in Romans, the first chapter, and not wonder if sometimes our priorities haven't been skewed and misunderstood. As I mentioned earlier, as followers of Christ, we indeed have a huge responsibility to obey our government and to not cause disturbances and unrest. But as we find in Acts, the 5th chapter, the 29th verse, it says, "But Peter and the apostles answered, 'We must obey God rather than any human authority. And if it should come to pass that our government asks us to do something which contradicts what the Lord has asked us to do, I think we have a responsibility to indeed follow the Lord.'" We find the instructions for obeying the government in Romans, the 13th chapter, the first 7 verses. It talks about our relationship as Christians to the government. Titus 3, verses 1 and 2 said, "Remind them to be subject to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle and to show every courtesy to everyone." I propose to you, brothers and sisters, that the best thing we can do for our rulers and for our government, if we are not comfortable or we do not agree with something that they have done, is to pray for them. I think praying for our rulers and for our government is more powerful than anything that we might otherwise consider doing. But it's only when our government asks us to do something that contradicts the New Testament can we really be justified in not obeying them and in not following what they would have us to do. I ask you to consider for a moment what it is we are trying to accomplish. I lay out for you that I think what we are trying to accomplish are things of a spiritual nature. And if it's indeed spiritual results that we want and spiritual things that we are after, doesn't it follow suit that it would be spiritual means and spiritual methods by which we would seek to conduct this behavior? Because as Christians, we're trying to reform the hearts of unbelievers. We are not here to try and reform the laws that we don't have an agreement with. I just read for you Romans, the first chapter, 16th verse, and I think that is really the crux of my lesson this morning. Because having read that, we find that it is there that we have the power. The power is in the gospel. The power is not in organized protest and picketing and things of that nature. But the power to change things lies within the gospel and its message. If in fact it lies within the gospel, and it is in that message, then why do so many people want to resort to political rhetoric and to political ideology when indeed it's not necessary in any way, shape, or form? The problems facing our country, the problems facing most of the citizens that we come encounter with every single day, are problems of a spiritual nature and not of a political nature. We have too many people in this country who do not have a knowledge of a holy God. And it is not through laws and things of that nature that they are going to come and understand exactly what a holy God is and what he has done for them. 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, verses 3 and 4 read, "Indeed, we live as human beings, but we do not wage war according to human standards. For the weapons of our warfare are not merely human, but they have divine power to destroy strongholds." Ephesians 6, 10 through 18 also touches upon the same topic and subject there. Charles Colson, was a former White House aide of President Richard Nixon. Now I'd like to read the following quote that he had to say here. He said, "Today's misspent enthusiasm for political solutions to the moral problems of our culture arises from a distorted view of both politics and Christianity. Too low a view of the power of God and too high a view of the ability of man. The idea that human systems reformed by Christian influence pave the road to the kingdom, or at least to revival, has the same utopian ring that one finds in Marxist literature. It also ignores the consistent lesson of history that shows that laws are most often reformed as a result of a powerful spiritual movement, not vice versa. I know of no case where a spiritual movement was achieved by passing laws." No. Certainly there will be laws in this country that are passed that we may not agree with. It doesn't mean we don't have a responsibility to follow. And I don't think that we necessarily have to agree with every law that this country has. Certainly we probably don't agree with every law on the books as it stands right now. But we find in Daniel, the second chapter, the first 14th verse, "Then Daniel responded with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the king's chief executioner, who had gone out to execute the wise men of Babylon." Daniel wasn't leading a protest here. Daniel wasn't trying to disobey. Daniel was using discernment, and he was stating to his king there that he just disagreed with what he was doing. We find similar instances in Acts, the 26th chapter, where Paul pays respect to the governing authority to whom he is subject to. Colossians, the 4th chapter, verses 5 and 6 read, "Conduct yourselves wisely to outsiders, making the most of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer everyone." 1 Peter 2, verse 17, clearly tells us that we are to honor the king. One thing we need to understand is that our country and our government are not our home. From Philippians 3:20, it says that our citizenship is in heaven. Our citizenship really isn't here in the United States on a spiritual level. Hebrews, the 11th chapter, tells us clearly that we are strangers and exiles here on earth. So why are we so often tempted to get caught up in the message of the world and not follow the mandate of the church? One misnomer that I think a lot of people have is this idea that this great country of ours was founded as a Christian nation. And I think when people look more closely at some of our founding fathers, I think they would be a little surprised at what they would find. John Adams, the second president of our United States, did not even believe in the Trinity as it exists in the New Testament. Thomas Jefferson, the person who penned our Declaration of Independence, wrote his own Bible, omitting all of the miracles of Jesus because he did not feel that supernatural power existed and he didn't feel the miracles were valid. We have a Declaration of Independence and a Constitution of our country that make no mention of Jesus Christ. We have a Constitution that makes no mention of God. I find it ironic that people are so determined to use the argument that our nation was so strongly founded upon the principles of the Bible, when we look at some of the beliefs of our founding fathers, they were indeed contrary to some of our beliefs today. This idea of a social gospel that we can make society better. People don't want to make society better through understanding the Bible, through the teachings of the Old and New Testament, through intelligent biblical discussions, but it's through legislation, it's through political reform, it's through these kind of methods that we are going to save our country and we are going to save the world. I'd like to read one more quote from Charles Colson. He said that's one of the weaknesses of the evangelical movement today, that it is so obsessed with politics. It believes that there's got to be a political solution to everything. You don't change a culture by passing laws. You change a culture by changing people's habits. But yet we think that politicians, if they pass the right laws, are going to help people understand what marriage is all about, or they're going to understand what the life issue and abortion is all about. And they're all of a sudden going to understand, if we can just get our legislation pushed through, then the light will shine and everyone will come to understand. I want to talk more this morning about whether or not we should be involved. I don't really want to go through every single political issue and talk about where we should stand or where I stand and things of that nature. But one issue that is, you're going to hear about it in the next 3 months, up until our election, whether you like politics, whether you care about it or not, you're going to be hard-pressed not to hear about this. And it's going to be simply this idea of abortion, that these people are pro-life, and that these people are pro-choice. And I submit to you that I'm more pro-life, or as pro-life, as anyone in this audience. But sometimes, as I hear the pro-life people talk about their legislation, I don't laugh, but I find it interesting that they think that if they can get the Supreme Court to overturn a law, that all of a sudden people are going to appreciate life more, all of a sudden abortions will cease to exist in this country. I submit to you, there were abortions in this country before 1973. And should we get Supreme Court justices that change that law back, abortions are not going to stop. If the girl next door is pregnant and she's about to have an abortion, it's not going to be a ruling from the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. that changes her mind. It's going to be somebody like you and me that go and talk to her about the gospel and talk to her about what Jesus has done that's going to persuade her not to do that. Take drugs, for example. Drugs are illegal in this country. It doesn't stop very many people from doing it. Nearly everyone who wants to use drugs in this country uses them irregardless. People don't use drugs until they've made that decision in their mind and they understand that there's a better way of life. They're not going to cease to use drugs just because the government tells them not to do so. A lot of good people put a lot of effort into this legislation and into these laws. But one thing I think we need to keep in mind is that as fast as the law is passed, it can be overturned, changed, and amended just as quickly. And even though we may think we've got a law on the books now that is going to serve our country well, it's only temporal. These things will not last. But if you share with someone what Jesus has done for them, and you share with them what we find in Romans, the first chapter, 16th verse, that is something that's going to stick with that person forever, and that will forever last. Our government serves a purpose. It does not serve the purpose of giving us moral answers and moral guidance and moral leadership. Psalms 146:3 says, "Do not put your trust in princes, in mortals in whom there is no help." Jeremiah 17:5 says, "Cursed are those who trust in mere mortals and make mere flesh their strength, whose hearts turn away from the Lord." Certainly morality and justice are definitely things that need to be pursued. They are things that need to be pursued according to the Scriptures, and only according to the Scriptures. The early church had just as many problems in their society as we did, if not more. They had issues with crime, they had issues with drunkenness, they had nearly every issue in some way, shape, or form that we have today. But you don't find anywhere in the New Testament where people are seeking moral reform with zealots and things of that nature. Because that was not what they were called to do. If you look at Jesus Christ himself, he never tried to change anything by going within a political agenda. He tried to change things by going to people one at a time and teaching to them and changing hearts one at a time. Certainly the remedy here is spiritual in nature. And I think we get this idea that if we can pass the laws that it's kind of this outwardly virtuous thing that, all right, the laws are good, now we're good. But it's within our heart. It's when we've transformed our hearts and accepted really the gospel as it is that things will make a turn for the better. John 18:36 says, "My kingdom is not of this world." 2 Corinthians 10 said, "The weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh." Ephesians 6:12, "Our struggle is against flesh and blood." It's not against flesh and blood. As I cited in Philippians 3:20, "Our citizenship is indeed in heaven." 1 Peter 2:11, "Strangers and aliens within this world." We need to set eternal goals. We need to have an eternal focus. We don't need to come up with these temporary aids, these temporary helps to a society and into a world that is doomed for destruction no matter what it is that we may do with regards to our government. Some of you may be thinking I'm being a little hard-hearted here, not very compassionate, not very sympathetic. But I urge you to take a look into the New Testament and take a look at the early church. The early church clearly had a way of taking care of people. In Matthew 26, it says, "But when the disciples saw it, they were angry and said, 'Why this waste? For this ointment could have gone and been sold for a large sum, and the money given to the poor.'" Acts chapter 6. "Now during those days, when the disciples were increasing in number, the Hellenists complained against the Hebrews because their widows were being neglected in the daily distribution of food." Galatians chapter 2. "They ask only one thing, that we remember the poor, which was actually what I was eager to do." And Titus 3. "And let people learn to devote themselves to good works in order to meet urgent needs, so that they may not be unproductive." That indeed was not the social gospel. That indeed was the gospel of the New Testament. Like I mentioned earlier, the Roman government with which the early church was subject to, I feel confident in saying, was far worse than the government we live under today. But I think it's the wise man, it's the person who has wisdom, that understands there are indeed serious limitations on what it is that political and social action and reform can do for a person. 1 Peter, the second chapter, verses 18 through 20, I'd like to read real quick. "Slaves, accept the authority of your masters with all deference, not only those who are kind and gentle, but also those who are harsh. For it is a credit to you if, being aware of God, you endure pain while suffering unjustly. If you endure when you are beaten for doing wrong, what credit is that? But if you endure when you do right and suffer for it, you have God's approval." Peter here, if you remember, was the one who was with Jesus. He was the one who was ready to take up arms against the government. He was the person who was ready to literally go to battle for the cause of Christ. And here later, as he's writing in 1 Peter, the second chapter, he tells him to patiently endure. I think through time he understood that it wasn't going to be with literal warfare, with literal heads-on attacking the government, that things were going to be done. He understood that if you just patiently endure, that in the end, it will all work out the way we have it. Didn't sound very politically motivated to me, what he wrote there in 1 Peter, the second chapter. And as we look at the example of Paul in Acts, the 24th chapter, when he goes before King Agrippa, and before that he goes before Festus, he doesn't go before them with any sort of a political agenda. I'm sure he traveled a good portion of the Roman Empire. I'm sure he got to see a lot of things that he probably didn't agree with, that he didn't approve of. But when he was given the opportunity to speak before these men, he spoke about the faith that he had in Jesus Christ. He did not speak to them about this law, that law, what can you do about this, what can you do about that. Certainly, some may say that he was too heavenly minded there with no earthly good. But I would submit to you that he had a fuller understanding of what his purpose here on this earth was. And he knew more than any other what it was he could do to change these people's lives. I heard a survey results on the radio a few weeks back when I was beginning to prepare for this. And it listed the three most disliked, that wasn't the word they used, but I'll let you imagine what word they used. Three most disliked groups of people in the United States. And they were politicians, lawyers, and the media, in that order. Brings us back to my initial question. Should Christians be involved in politics? Well, I'm sure many of you are asking, what about voting? Should we vote? What about petitions? Is it wrong for me to sign my name to a petition? Is it wrong for me to call my congressman and tell him that I don't agree with this law and that law? Is it wrong for me to write my city councilman a letter and tell him that I don't agree with that? I would submit to you that no, I do not think that is wrong. Paul used his rights as a Roman citizen, and I think our government has given us the right to vote. And should we use that right and we want to cast our vote for this or that, I do not think that is wrong. At the same time, we must keep in mind that if we vote and it does not go the way we want it to go, we've got to keep in mind that this is only temporal. It's not really a big deal. On the same token, should a person not want to vote? Should a person choose not to vote? I think that is equally fine and equally appropriate. I think it's a right that we've been given, and I don't see that in any way contradicts any teachings within the New Testament. three things I'd like for you to think about as I recap here, as far as involvement within politics. Certainly we all come from different communities, we all come from different environments as far as the local government and so forth. But three things I'd like for you to keep in mind in terms of being involved in politics is time. Politics can take up a lot of time. And is that time well spent? Is that time spent on the best things that we can spend our time doing? Second thing I'd like for you to consider as I close here this morning is, do you find examples of Jesus or any of his apostles or any of the prominent figures in the New Testament with a political agenda seeking political reform? Third thing I'd like for you to consider is, what is your goal in engaging in this? Is that the only way that that goal can be accomplished? Or can it not be accomplished through some other measure, through some other means, as we found in Romans 1:16? I mentioned briefly earlier the three institutions which God has set up for us. And each institution is beautifully designed the way God would have it. And it is our responsibility to keep these institutions pure, to use these institutions as the way God outlined them for us in the New Testament, and not to try and blend these institutions together, crisscross, and misunderstand what it is that God would have each institution to do for us. In Acts the 26th chapter, we find a case there where he's before Agrippa, and he's talking to him about his faith in Jesus Christ. In the few verses leading up to that, you would think that he's making inroads with Agrippa, because Agrippa really is having a hard time not believing what Paul is telling him. But that story concludes with the statement that thou has almost persuaded me. I really think that Agrippa believed Paul, but he just didn't believe him to the point where he could really act upon it, where he could really accept it and turn it over to the gospel. I've shared with a few of you before, so I apologize if you've heard this, but before I became a Christian, I had decided in my mind, months prior to that, before I'd actually taken action and done something about it. But the mere fact that I had made up my mind within my mind was not enough. Because you have to take action. You have to follow the steps that are found in the New Testament. If any of you are out here who have been considering this for the last few weeks, or maybe you just started considering it this morning, I urge you to consider your position. And I urge you to realize and to understand that just because you may have made that decision within your mind, until you confess, until you actually repent, until you are immersed in the waters of baptism, having just made up your mind is not enough. So if this morning is the right time for you, if it is the time when you would like to begin your walk with Jesus Christ, I'd urge you to make your way up to the front as Shane leads number 600 for us.
Other things to do when you get bored of reading, you can look up there once in a while, change it so it might be a little more interesting. And Brother Brad Bratchard has volunteered to do some reading for me too from the scriptures, so you can listen to him instead of having to listen to me all the time. Why I am still a member of the Church of Christ. Several of you probably are wondering that. Why is he still here? And then it follows with some tart remark like he leads the songs too fast. Or he has facial hair that looks like he's from the 70s still. Or something along that line. If that's your concern,
just hang out for 2 weeks. I'll be gone back to California, and you won't have to tolerate me again for another year or so. I intend to answer this question actually in 3 different ways besides that way. I guess that really wasn't an answer. You'll just have to put up with it if that's your concern. Here's the quick and easy answer. Assuming we define the Church of Christ as the organization here on earth, why I'm still a member of the Church of Christ? 2 quick answers to that. Jesus hasn't come yet, and I haven't died yet. Thank you, brethren, for inviting me here. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. That really should be the answer to this question. But I'm assuming the brethren wanted a little bit more than that. So we'll try it from perhaps a little different angle. Let's see if I can get these all messed up. Well, I'm still a member of the Church of Christ, and we'll take it at least at this moment from the angle of, rather than being a member of no church, why am I a Christian of any flavor? Well, the answers, again, are really pretty simple, and it doesn't require a lot of heavy thinking. Here's the first part of it. I believe that Jesus Christ is our Savior. Let's have our first reading from John 14 and verse 6.
Jesus saith unto him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me.
I am the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. I love my Jewish friends. I have friends who are Buddhists. I have friends who practice Islam. I love them, but they aren't going to make it to heaven as long as they hold to those faiths. Many of them are good, honest, hard-working people. But I believe that Jesus says, I'm not a way or one of the many ways, I'm the way. I believe Jesus when he said that. And if you're going to make it to heaven, if you're going to come to God, it has to be through him. I think that's a fairly simple concept. Our next reading, please. I also believe that there is a heaven and a hell. Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 46.
When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, and all the holy angels with him, then shall he sit upon the throne.